he said. The boy did as he was told, but his focus was now caught on the needle.
Why do you want medicine? Are you sick?
For my brother.
Also Luna.
The boy's eyes widened. They always did when Dr. Erland threw out the words so casually. But he never understood why. He only asked for Lunars. Only Lunars ever knocked on his door.
Stop looking so skittish, Dr. Erland grumbled. You must know that I'm Luna too.
He did a quick glamour to prove himself, an easy manipulation so that the boy perceived him as a younger version of himself, but only for an instant. Though he'd been tampering with bioelectricity more freely since he'd arrived in Africa, he found that it drained him more and more. His mind simply wasn't as strong as it used to be, and it had been years since he'd had any consistent practice. Nevertheless, the glamour did its job. The boy's stance relaxed, now that he was somewhat sure that Dr. Erland wouldn't have him and his family sent to the moon for execution. He still didn't come any closer, though.
Yes, he said. My brother is Lunar too, but he's a shell.
This time, it was Erland's eyes that widened.
A shell? Now that had true value. Though many Lunars came to Earth in order to protect their non-gifted children, tracking those children down had proven more difficult than Erland had expected. They blended in too well with Earthans, and they had no desire to give up their disguise. He wondered if half of them were even aware of their own ancestry.
How old? He said, setting the syringe down on the counter. I would pay double for a sample from him.
At Erland's sudden eagerness, the boy took a step back.
7, he said. But he's sick.
With what? I have painkillers, blood thinners, antibiotics.
He has the plague, sir. Do you have medicine for that?
Dr. Erland frowned.
Letemosis? No. No, that isn't possible. Tell me his symptoms. We'll figure out what he really has.
The boy looked annoyed at being told he was wrong, but not without a tinge of hope.
Yesterday afternoon, he started getting a bad rash with bruises all over his arms, like he'd been in a brawl. Except he hadn't. When he woke up this morning, he was hot to the touch, but he kept saying he was freezing, even in this heat. When our mother checked, the skin under his fingernails had gone bluish, just like the plague.
Erland held up a hand.
You say he got the spots yesterday, and his fingers were already turning blue this morning.
The boy nodded.
Also, right before I came here, all those spots were blistering up like blood blisters.
He cringed. Alarm stirred inside the doctor as his mind searched for an explanation. The first symptoms did sound like letemosis, but he'd never heard of it moving through its 4 stages so quickly. And the rash becoming blood blisters? He'd never seen that before. He didn't want to think of the possibility, and yet it was also something he'd been waiting for years to happen. Something he'd been expecting. Something he'd been dreading. If what this boy said was true, if his brother did have letemosis, then it could mean that the disease was mutating. And if even a Lunar was showing symptoms. Erland grabbed his hat off the desk and pulled it on over his balding head.
Take me to him.
Chapter 8. Cress hardly felt the hot water beating on her head. Outside her washroom, a second-era opera blared from every screen. With the woman's powerful voice in her ears, swooning over the incessant shower, Cress was the star, the damsel, the center of that universe. She sang along at full volume, pausing only to prepare herself for the crescendo. She didn't have the full translation memorized, but the emotions behind the words were clear. Heartbreak. Tragedy. Love. Chills covered her skin, sharply contrasted against the steam. She pressed a hand to her chest, drowning. Pain. loneliness, love. It always came back to love. More than freedom, more than acceptance. Love, true love, like they sang about in the Second Era. The kind that filled up a person's soul. The kind that lent itself to dramatic gestures and sacrifices. The kind that was irresistible and all-encompassing. The woman's voice rose in intensity with the violins and cellos, a climax sung up into the shower's downpour. Cress held the note as long as she could, enjoying the way the song rolled over her, filling her with its power. She ran out of breath first, suddenly dizzy. Panting, she fell against the shower wall. The crescendo died down into a simple, longing finale, just as the water sputtered out. All of Cress's showers were timed to ensure her water reserves wouldn't run out before Mistress Sybil's next supply visit. Cress sank down and wrapped her arms around her knees, realizing there were tears on her cheeks. She covered her face and laughed. She was being ridiculously melodramatic. But it was well-deserved. Because today was the day. She'd been following the Rampion's path closely since they'd agreed to rescue her nearly 14 hours before, and they had not deviated from their course. The Rampion would be crossing through her satellite's trajectory in approximately 1 earthen hour and 15 minutes. She would have freedom, and friendships, and purpose. And she would be with him. In the next room, the operatic solo began again, quiet and slow and tinged with longing. "Thank you," Cress whispered to the imaginary audience that was going mad with applause. She imagined lifting a bouquet of red roses and smelling them, even though she had no idea what roses smelled like. With that thought, the fantasy disintegrated. Sighing, she picked herself off the shower floor before the tips of her hair could get sucked down the drain. Her hair weighed heavy on her scalp. It was easy to ignore when she was caught up in such a powerful solo, but now the weight of it threatened to make her topple over, and a dull headache was already creeping up from the base of her skull. This was not the day for headaches. She held up the ends of her hair with one hand, taking some pressure off her head, and spent a few minutes wringing it out, handful by soaking handful. Emerging from the shower, she grabbed her towel, a ratty gray thing she'd had for years, worn to holes in the corners. "Volume down!" she yelled out to the main room. The opera faded into the background. A few last droplets from the shower head dribbled onto the floor. Cress heard a chime. She pulled her hair through her fists again, gathering another handful of water and shaking it out of the shower before wrapping herself in the towel. The weight of her hair still tugged at her, but was feeling manageable again. In the main room, all but the single DCOM screen were showing the theater footage. The shot was a close-up of the woman's face, thick with makeup and penciled eyebrows, a lion's mane of fire-red hair topped with a gold crown. The DCOM screen held a new message. From user mechanic, ETA, 68 minutes. Cress was buoyed by giddiness. It was happening. They were really coming to rescue her. She dropped the towel to the floor and grabbed the wrinkled dress she'd been wearing before. The dress that was a little too small and a little too short because Sybil had brought it for Cress when she was only 13, but that was worn to the perfect softness. It was Cress's favorite dress. Not that it had a lot of competition. She pulled it over her head, then rushed back into the bathroom to begin the long process of combing out her wet tangles. She wanted to look presentable, after all. No, she wanted to look irresistible. But there was no use dwelling on that. She had no makeup, no jewelry, no perfume, no properly fitting clothes, and only the most basic essentials for daily hygiene. She was as pale as the moon, and her hair would dry frizzy, no matter how she coddled it. After a moment of staring at herself in the mirror, she decided to braid it, her best hope for keeping it tamed. She had just divided it into three sections at the nape of her neck when Little Cress's voice squeaked.
Big sister?
Cress froze. She met her own wide-eyed gaze in the mirror.
Yes? Mistress's ship detected. Expected arrival in 22 seconds.
No, no, no. Not today, she hissed. Releasing her wet strands of hair, she rushed out into the main room. For once, her few belongings weren't strewn across the floor and tabletops, because they were all packed neatly inside a pulled-out drawer that sat on top of her bed. Dresses, socks, and undergarments neatly folded alongside hair combs and barrettes and what food packs she still had from Sybil's last visit. She'd even nestled her favorite pillow and blankets on top. All evidence that she was running away.
Oh, stars!
She swept forward and grabbed the drawer with both hands, pulling it off the bed. She tore out the blanket and pillow and tossed them onto the mattress before dragging the heavy drawer over to the desk she'd taken it from.
00, 14, 00, 13, 00, 12,
sang little Cress as she wrestled the drawer back into place. It wouldn't shut. Cress squatted beside it, eyeing the rails to either side of the drawer. It took 7 more seconds of harried finagling before she managed to slam the drawer shut. Sweat or water from her still wet hair dripped down the back of her neck. Tugging out a lock of hair that had gotten caught in the drawer, she hastily straightened the bed as well as she could.
Mistress has arrived. She is requesting an extension of the docking clamp.
I'm getting there, Cress responded, darting toward the boarding ramp screen and entering the code. She turned back to the room as the clamp extended outside her walls, as Sybil's ship attached, as oxygen filled the space. The opera singer was still there, and Mistress would be annoyed at Cress's waste of time, but at least it wasn't... She gasped, her eyes landing on the one screen that stood out from the rest and the single bright green message on a field of black. From user mechanic, ETA 68 minutes. She heard Sybil's steps approaching as she launched herself across the room. She shut down the screen just as the satellite door whistled open. Hard in her throat, Cress spun around and smiled. Sybil met her gaze from the doorway. She was already glaring, but Cress thought her eyes narrowed even more in that moment between seeing Cress and noting her brilliant grin.
Mistress, what a surprise! I just got out of the shower, was just listening to some opera.
She gulped, her mouth suddenly dry. Sybil's eyes darkened, and she cast them around the room, at the screen still quietly transmitting the opera singer engrossed in her song. Sybil sneered.
Earthen music.
Cress chewed on her lower lip. She knew there were musicians and plays and all sorts of entertainments for the lunar court, but they were rarely recorded, and Cress didn't have access to them. Lunars generally disliked having their true appearances transmitted for all the galaxy to see. They much preferred live performances where they could alter the audience's perception of their skills.
All screens mute, she murmured, trying to stop shaking.
In the wake of silence, Sybil stepped inside, allowing the door to shut behind her. Cress gestured to the familiar metal box Sybil carried.
I don't believe I'm in need of any supplies, mistress. Is it time for another blood sample already?
She asked, knowing it wasn't. Sybil set the box on the bed, sparing a distasteful glance for the rumpled blankets.
I have a new assignment for you, Crescent. I trust you noticed that one of our primary feeds from New Beijing Palace was disabled last week.
Cress willed herself to look natural, collected, and unworried.
Yes, the recorder from the Emperor's office.
Her Majesty found it to be one of the more lucrative feeds we've placed on Earth. She wants another programmed and installed immediately.
She opened the box, revealing a collection of chips and recording devices.
As before, the signal should be untraceable. We don't want it drawing any attention to itself.
Cress nodded, perhaps too enthusiastically.
Of course, mistress. It won't take long. I can have it finished tomorrow. I'm sure it will be disguised in a light fixture, like the last one?
No, we risked too much by brainwashing the maintenance attendant before. Make it so that it can be more easily hidden. Able to embed on a wall hanging, perhaps. One of the other thaumaturges will likely handle the installation themselves during our upcoming visit.
Cress's head was still bobbing.
Yes, yes, of course, no problem.
Sybil scowled. Perhaps Cress was being too agreeable. She stopped nodding, but it was difficult to focus as a clock ticked in her head. If Cinder and the others spotted the lunar podship attached to her satellite, they would think Cress had led them into a trap. But Mistress Sybil never stayed long. Surely she would be well gone before the hour was up. Surely.
Is there anything else, Mistress?
Have you anything to report on the other earthen feeds?
Cress strained to think about any news she may have heard in the past few days. Her skills in cyber espionage went beyond research and hacking into earthen feeds and databases, or programming spy equipment to be strategically installed in various homes and offices of high-ranking officials. It was also one of her responsibilities to monitor those feeds and report anything interesting back to Sybil and Her Majesty. It was the most voyeuristic part of her job, which she hated. But at least if Sybil was asking her about it now, it meant that she and the Queen hadn't had time lately to monitor the feeds themselves.
Everyone's focused on the wedding, Cress said. Lots of talk of travel arrangements and scheduling diplomatic meetings while so many representatives are together in New Beijing.
She hesitated before continuing.
A lot of Earthens are questioning Emperor Kato's decision to enter into the alliance and whether or not it will really signal an end to the attacks. The European Federation recently placed a large order from a weapons manufacturer. It seems they're preparing for war. I could find the specifics of that order if you want.
Don't waste your time. We know what they're capable of. Anything else?
Cress searched her memory. She considered telling Mistress Sybil that one UK representative, a Mr. Bristol something, was trying to make a political statement by rejecting his invitation to the royal wedding, but she determined that his decision might still change. Knowing Her Majesty, she would want to set the man up as an example, and Cress didn't want to think what she would do to him, or his family.
No, Mistress, that's all.
And what about the cyborg? Any progress there?
She had told the lie so many times it was effortless on her tongue.
I'm sorry, Mistress, I haven't found anything new.
Do you suppose, Crescent, that her ability to go without detection is due to a similar technique we use to disguise our ships?
Cress pulled her damp hair away from her neck.
Perhaps. I understand she's a talented mechanic. Her skills may include software jamming.
And if that's the case, would you be able to detect it?
Cress opened her mouth, but hesitated. She most likely could, but telling Sybil that would be a mistake. She would only wonder why Cress hadn't thought of doing it sooner.
I don't think so, Mistress, but I'll try. I'll see what I can find.
See that you do. I'm sick of making excuses for you.
Cress tried to look regretful, but her fingers were tingling with relief. Sybil always said some variation of this line when she was preparing to leave.
Of course, Mistress. Thank you for bringing me this new work, Mistress.
A chime sang through the room. Cress recoiled, but instantly attempted to morph her expression into nonchalance. Just another chime, just another non-suspicious alert for one of Cress's non-suspicious hobbies. Sybil had no reason to question it. But Sybil's attention had swerved to the single black screen that had awoken with the alert. A new message had appeared.
Message received from mechanic. ETA, 41 minutes. Need final coordinates.
The satellite tilted beneath Cress. But no, it was her own balance leaving her.
What is this? Sybil said, nearing the screen.
It's a game. I've been playing it with the computer.
Her voice squeaked. Her face was warming, cooled only where her damp hair clung to her cheeks. There was a long silence.
Cress tried to feign indifference. Just a silly game. Imagining the computer is a real person. You know how my imagination can be when I get lonely. Sometimes it's nice to have someone to talk to, even if they're not.
Sybil grabbed Cress's jaw, shoving her hand against a window that overlooked the blue planet.
Is it her? Sybil hissed. Have you been lying to me?
Cress couldn't speak, her tongue heavy with terror, as if she were pinned by a glamour. But this was not magic. This was only a woman strong enough and angry enough to tear Cress's arms from their sockets, to break her skull against the corner of the desk.
You had better not even think to lie to me, Crescent. How long have you been communicating with her?
Her lips trembled.
Since yesterday, she half sobbed. I was trying to earn her trust. I thought if I could get close enough, I could tell you and...
A slap sent the world spinning, and Cress hit the floor. Her cheek burned, and her brain took a moment to stop rattling inside her skull.
You hoped she was going to rescue you, said Sybil.
No, no, mistress.
After all I've done for you, saved your life when your parents meant to have you slaughtered.
I know, mistress. I was going to bring her to you, mistress. I was trying to help.
I even allowed you net access to watch those disgusting earthen feeds, and this is how you repay me?
Sybil eyed the screen where the message still lingered. But at least you've finally done something useful. Cress shuddered. Her brain began to cloud with the instinctual need to run, to escape. She shoved herself off the floor, but tripped on her hair and landed hard against the closed doors. Her fingers sought out the keypad, punching in the command. The doors zipped open. She did not wait to see Sybil's reaction.
Closed door!
Cress flew down the corridor, lungs burning. She couldn't breathe. She was hyperventilating. She had to get out. Another door loomed before her. An identical switch beside it. She barreled into it.
Open!
It did. She stumbled forward and her abdomen smacked into a railing. She grunted from the collision, bracing herself before she could topple over it and straighten into the cockpit. She stood, panting and staring wide-eyed at the interior of a small pod ship. Lights and flashing panels and screens glowed all around her. The windows formed a wall of glass separating her from a sea of stars. And there was a man. His hair was the color of golden straw, and his body strong and broad in his royal uniform. He looked like he could be threatening, but at that moment, he seemed only astonished. He raised himself from the pilot seat. They gawked at each other as Cress struggled to find words amid her tumbling thoughts. Sybil did not come alone. Sybil had a pilot that brought her here. Another human being knew that Cress existed. No, another lunar knew that Cress existed.
Help me,
she tried to whisper, gulping when the words couldn't form.
Please, please help me.
He shut his mouth. Cress's hands twitched on the bar.
Please,
her voice broke. The man flexed his fingers and she thought, was it only her imagination? His eyes seemed to soften, to sympathize, or to calculate. His hand shifted toward the controls, the command to shut the door, to disengage from the satellite, to fly her away from the prison.
I don't suppose you killed her, he said.
The words seemed like they came from a different language altogether. He said them emotionlessly, a simple question, expecting a simple answer. Killed her? Killed her? Before she could form a response, the guard's eyes sped past her. Sybil grabbed a fistful of Cress's hair and yanked her back toward the corridor. Cress screamed and collapsed onto the ground.
Jason, we're about to have company, said Sybil, ignoring Cress's sobs. Separate yourself from the satellite, but stay close enough to have good visual without drawing suspicion. When an earthen ship draws close, they will likely release one pod ship. Wait until the pilot has boarded the satellite and then rejoin us using the opposite entry hatch. I will ensure the clamp is pre-extended.
Cress trembled, nonsense words falling from her in hopeless pleas. The man's sympathy and astonishment were gone, vanished as if they'd never been there. Perhaps they never had. He jerked his head in a nod, no question, no thought to disobey. Though Cress screamed and kicked, Sybil managed to drag her all the way back to the satellite's main room, tossing her like a bag of broken android parts on the floor. The door shut behind them, dividing her from the exit, from her freedom, and with its familiar clang, she knew. She would never be free. Sybil was going to kill her. and she was going to kill Lynn Cinder and Carswell Thorne. When Cress pushed back her mess of hair, a sob shook her to the bones. Sybil was smiling.
I suppose I should thank you. Lynn Cinder is going to come to me, and our queen will be so pleased.
Bending down, Sybil grasped Cress's chin in a claw-like grip.
Unfortunately, I don't think you'll survive long enough to receive your reward.
Chapter 9. Cinder groaned, the impact of her most recent landing still reverberating through her spine. The cargo bay's ceiling spun and wobbled in her vision.
Was that necessary?
Wolf and Scarlet appeared above her.
I'm sorry, said Wolf. I thought you had control. Are you all right?
Frustrated and sore, but yes, I'm fine.
She forced herself to take Wolf's outstretched hand. He and Scarlet both helped her to her feet.
You're right, I lost focus. I felt your energy snap out of my hold like a rubber band.
That was moments before Wolf completed the maneuver she'd managed to halt for 6 whole seconds, grasping her arm and tossing her over his shoulder. She rubbed her hip.
I need a moment.
Maybe you should call it quits for the day, said Scarlet. We're almost to the satellite.
Iko chimed in.
Estimated time of arrival is 9 minutes, 34 seconds, which, by my estimation, is enough time for Cinder to be defeated and embarrassed in 7 more brawls.
Cinder glared up at the ceiling.
Also just enough time to disconnect your audio device.
Since we have a few minutes, said Scarlet, maybe we should talk about how to handle this girl. If she's been stuck on a satellite for 7 years with no one to talk to but a lunar thaumaturge, she might be socially awkward. I think we should all make an effort to be extra welcoming and supportive and try not to terrify her.
A laugh came from the cockpit, and Thorne appeared in the doorway, strapping a gun holster around his waist. You're asking the cyborg fugitive and the wild animal to be the welcoming committee? That's adorable. Scarlet planted her hands on her hips.
I'm saying we should be aware of what she's been through and try to be sensitive to that. This may not be an easy transition for her.
Thorne shrugged. The Rampian is going to be like a 5-star hotel after living on that satellite. She'll adjust.
I'll be nice to her, said Iko. I can take her net shopping, and she can help me pick out my future designer wardrobe. Look, I found this custom escort shop that has the best accessories and some discounted models. What would you think of me with orange hair?
The net screen on the wall switched to an escort droid sale listing. The image of a model was slowly rotating, showing off the android's perfect proportions, peachy skin, and royalty-approved posture. She had purple irises and cropped tangerine hair and a tattoo of an old-fashioned carousel that rotated around her ankle. Cinder squeezed an eye shut.
Iko, what does this have to do with the satellite girl?
I was getting to that.
The screen scrolled through a menu, landing on hair accessories and dozens of icons clustered together, showing everything from dreadlocked wigs to cat-ear headbands to rhinestone-encrusted barrettes.
Just think of how much potential she has with hair like that.
You see, said Thorne, nudging Scarlet in the shoulder. Iko and the imprisoned, socially awkward satellite girl, best friends forever. Now, what I'm worried about is how we're going to be dividing the reward money when this is all over, because this ship is starting to feel awfully crowded, and I'm not sure I'm happy with all of you cutting into my profits.
What reward money? Asked Scarlet.
The reward Cinder's gonna pay us out of the lunar treasury once she's queen. Cinder rolled her eyes.
I should have guessed.
And that's just the beginning. By the end of this escapade, the whole world will see us as heroes. Imagine the fame and fortune, the sponsorship opportunities, the marketing requests, net dramatization rights. I think we should discuss the profit division sooner rather than later, because I'm considering a 60-10-10-10-10 split right now.
Am I the fourth 10%? Said Aiko. Or is that satellite girl? Because if it's that satellite girl, I'm going on strike.
Can we discuss this imaginary money later? Said Cinder.
Like, maybe when there's actual money to discuss? Suggested Scarlet. Besides, don't you still have to prepare the pod ship?
Oui, mademoiselle.
With a salute, Thorn grabbed a handgun off a storage crate and sank it into the holster. Scarlet cocked her head.
Are you sure you don't want me to go? It's going to require some precise maneuvering to attach the docking clamp.
And from what Cinder told me about your flying skills...
What do you mean? What did Cinder say about my flying skills?
Scarlet and Cinder shared a look.
Naturally, she told me that you're a fantastic pilot, said Scarlet, grabbing her red hoodie off a crate.
Though it had been badly torn in Paris, she'd stitched it up as well as she could.
Absolutely top-notch.
I think she was practicing her sarcasm, said Aiko.
Thorn glared, but Cinder only shrugged.
I'm just saying, continued Scarlet, threading her arms through the sleeves, it may not be an easy attachment. You have to dock slowly, and don't leave the pod until you're sure the satellite system's compatible and you have a secure connection.
I can handle it, said Thorn.
Winking, he reached out and gave Scarlet's nose a tweak, ignoring how Wolf bristled behind her.
But you sure are sweet to be so concerned about me.
The docking clamp engaged on Thorn's second attempt, which he thought was pretty good for never having docked with a satellite before. He hoped Scarlet was watching, after she'd so brazenly doubted his abilities. He checked the connection before putting the pod ship into standby mode and unlatching his harness. Through the window, he could see the curving side of the satellite and one of its circular gyrodynes whirling lazily overhead, propelling the satellite through space. He could see only the edge of the docking hatch through the ship's windows, but it appeared secure, and his instruments were telling him that the pressure and oxygen levels made it safe to exit his ship. He tugged his collar away from his throat. He was not, by nature, a paranoid man, but dealing with lunars gave him more hesitation than he was accustomed to. Even young, semi-cute ones. Young, semi-cute ones who had probably been driven insane by years of solitude. Thorn unlatched the podship door and it swung upward, revealing two steps up to a ramp edged with a rail, and beyond it, a narrow corridor. His ears popped with the change in pressure. The entrance into the main satellite was still shut tight, but as he approached, he heard a hissing noise and the doors parted, sliding seamlessly into the walls. He recognized the room from the DCOM connection. Dozens of flat, clear screens, some overhead storage cabinets, a mussed-up bed with worn blankets, a wash of bluish-white light coming from built-in fixtures. A door to the left led to what he assumed was a washroom, and directly opposite him, there was the door to the second podship hatch. The girl was sitting on the edge of the bed, her hands in her lap, her hair pooling over both shoulders and ending in a bundle of knotted frizz by her shins. She was smiling, a close-lipped, polite look that was entirely at odds with the nerve-bundled reaction she had had over the DCOM. But that smile faltered when she saw him.
Oh, it's you, she said, tilting her head to the side. I was expecting the cyborg.
No need to look so disappointed, Thorn thrust his hands into his pockets. Cinder can fix ships, but she's useless at flying them.
I'll be your escort today. Captain Carswell Thorn, at your service.
He tipped his head toward her. Rather than swoon or flutter her lashes, as was duly expected of her, the girl looked away and glowered at one of the screens. Coughing, Thorn rocked back on his heels. Somehow he'd expected that a girl with no prior human interaction would be a lot easier to impress.
Are you all packed up? We don't like to loiter in one spot for long.
Her eyes flickered to him, hinting at annoyance.
No matter, she murmured to herself. Jason and I will go to her then.
Thorn frowned, feeling a twist of regret at his previous mocking, even if it had only been in his own head.
What if the solitude really had driven her crazy? Jason?
She stood up, her hair swinging against her ankles. He hadn't been able to tell how tall she was before, but now, seeing that she couldn't have been much more than 5 feet, he felt comforted. Crazy or not, she was harmless. Probably.
Jason, my guard.
Right. Well, why don't you invite your friend Jason to join us, and let's get going.
Oh, I don't think you'll be getting far.
She stepped toward him, and at that moment, she changed. The nest of hair grew dark and silky as a raven's wing. Her eyes changed from sky blue to slate gray. Her pale skin turned golden, and her body stretched upward, becoming tall and graceful. Even her clothes changed, from the plain, worn day dress to a dove-white coat with long sleeves. Thorn was quick to bury his surprise. A thaumaturge, figured. Not one for denial, he accepted the immediate resignation with a stiffening of his shoulders. It had all been a trap then. The girl had been bait, or perhaps she'd been in on it all along. Funny, he usually had better instincts when it came to these sorts of things. He stole another glance around the room, but there was no sign of the girl. Something clanged outside the second entry hatch, shaking the satellite. Hope. His crew must have noticed something was wrong. That would be them now aboard the second pod ship. He called up his most practiced, most charming grin and reached for his gun. He even felt a sting of pride when he managed to get it all the way out of its holster before his arm froze of its own accord. Thorn shrugged with the one uncontrolled shoulder. You can't blame me for trying. The thaumaturge smirked, and Thorn's fingers loosened. The gun clattered to the ground. Captain Carswell Thorn, is it?
That's right. I'm afraid you won't have claim to the title for long. I'm about to commandeer your Rampion for the Queen. I'm sorry to hear that.
Additionally, I assume you are aware that assisting a wanted fugitive, such as Lynn Cinder, is a crime punishable by death on Luna. Your sentence is to be carried out immediately.
Efficiency. I respect that.
The second entry door opened behind her. Thorn tried to send mental warnings to his companions. It was a trap. Be ready. But it was not Cinder or Scarlet or Wolf who stood in the secondary entry hatch, but a lunar guard. Thorn's hope began to wither.
Jason, we will be boarding the Rampion using its own pod ship.
Ah, you're Jason, said Thorn. I thought she was making you up. They ignored him, but he was rather used to that.
Go see that it's ready to disembark as soon as I'm finished here.
The guard respectfully inclined his head and moved to follow her commands.
Careful, said Thorn. It wasn't an easy connection. Required some real precise maneuvering. In fact, would you like me to come disconnect the ship for you just to make sure you do it right?
The guard eyed him smugly as he passed, not as empty-eyed as he'd appeared before. But he didn't respond as he slipped into the corridor, heading toward Thorn's pod ship. The thaumaturge grabbed a blanket from the bed and tossed it at Thorn. He would have caught it on reflex, but it wasn't necessary. His hands did all the work without him. Soon, he found himself wrapping the blanket around his own wrists and tying it into intricate knots, giving the blanket a final yank with his teeth to tighten it into place.
I look forward to returning to Luna aboard your ship and spreading the good news that Lynn Cinder is no longer a threat to our crown.
His eyebrow twitched.
Anything I can do to assist Her Majesty's benevolent cause?
The thaumaturge strode to a screen beside the hatch and entered a command, a security code followed by a complicated set of instructions.
I had at first considered turning off the life support and letting you and Crescent gasp for air as the oxygen was used up. But that could take too long, and I would hate to give you an opportunity to free yourselves and call for assistance. Instead, I will be merciful.
Finished, she straightened her long sleeves.
Consider yourself lucky that it will be quick.
I always consider myself lucky. Her gaze became hard as sterling, and Thorn found himself marching toward the open door that led to the washroom. As he got closer, he saw the girl tied up with a sheet around her hands, knees, and ankles, and a cloth gag in her mouth. As he got closer, he saw the girl tied up with a sheet around her hands, knees, and ankles, and a cloth gag in her mouth. Remnants of tears streaked down her blotchy face. Her hair was a tangled mess on the ground all around her, many of the locks caught up in her bindings. Thorn's gut tightened. He'd been sure that she had betrayed them, but her trembling body and horrified expression said otherwise. His knees gave way, and he landed on the floor with a grunt. The girl winced. Drawing a sharp breath through his nostrils, Thorn glared up at the thaumaturge.
"Is this all necessary? You're scaring the poor girl." "Crescent has no reason to be upset. It was her betrayal that brought us to this moment." "Right. The 5-foot-tall girl tied up and gagged in the bathroom is always the one to blame." "Besides," the thaumaturge continued as if he hadn't spoken, "I'm granting Crescent her greatest wish. I'm sending her to Earth."
She held up a small, shimmering chip, identical to the DCOM Cinder had been carrying around with her.
"I'm sure Crescent won't mind if I keep this. It is, after all, property of Her Majesty."
Her sleeves whipped behind her as she left. Thorn heard her heels clipping down the docking hatch and the doors shut behind her. His pod ship's engine was muffled, but he felt the slight jolt when they disconnected.
It was only then that he felt the first pang of helplessness. She'd taken his ship. That witch had taken his ship.
But the Rampian had a second shuttle. His crew could still come for them, would come for them. But then he sensed something new. A slight pull, a gentle shift, and the girl whimpered. The satellite's trajectory had been altered. Gravity was claiming them, drawing them out of their orbit. The satellite was falling toward Earth.
Chapter 10. "He's attached," said Scarlet, watching Thorn's pod ship through the cockpit viewing window.
"That wasn't too embarrassing."
Cinder propped herself against the doorframe.
"I hope he's quick about it. We have no way of knowing that this girl isn't being monitored."
"You don't trust her?" said Wolf.
"I don't trust who she works for."
"Wait, is that another ship?"
Scarlet jerked forward, pulling up a radar search on the screen beside her.
"Our scanners aren't seeing it."
Wolf and Cinder clustered behind her, peering down at the pod ship, only slightly larger than Thorn's, as it neared the satellite. Cinder's heart began to pound.
"Lunar."
"It has to be," said Scarlet.
"If they're blocking the signals."
"No, look, the insignia."
Wolf cursed.
"It's a royal ship. Probably a thaumaturge."
"She betrayed us," Cinder murmured, shaking her head in disbelief. "I don't believe it."
"Do we run?" asked Scarlet.
"And abandon Thorn?"
In the window, the lunar pod ship had connected with the satellite's second clamp. Cinder raked her fingers through her hair, her thoughts stumbling through her head.
"Calm them. Establish the DCOM link. We need to know what's going on."
"No," said Wolf. "It's possible they don't know we're here. Maybe she didn't betray us. If they didn't pick up our ship on radar, there's still a chance they haven't had visual of us."
"They would know Thorn's pod ship came from somewhere."
"Maybe he'll be able to get away," Aiko chimed in,
but there wasn't the normal enthusiasm to her tone.
"Against a thaumaturge? You saw how well that worked out in Paris."
"So what do we do?" said Scarlet. "We can't calm them. We can't dock."
"We should run," said Wolf. "They'll come for us next."
They both looked at Cinder, and she realized with a jolt that they expected her to take charge. But it wasn't a simple decision. Thorn was down there. He'd walked right into a trap, and this had all been Cinder's idea in the first place. She couldn't leave him. Her hands began to shake from gripping the chair. Every second of indecision was wasted time.
Cinder!
Scarlet placed a hand on her arm. It only made her squeeze the chair tighter.
We have to run. We have to run.
Scarlet nodded. She spun back to the controls.
Aiko, prep thrusters for...
Wait, said Wolf. Look!
Beyond the cockpit window, a podship was disconnecting from the satellite. Thorn's podship.
What's happening?
Aiko asked.
Cinder hissed. Thorn's ship is coming back. Calm him.
Scarlet pulled the comm screen up.
Thorn, report. What happened down there?
The screen returned only static. Cinder chewed on the inside of her cheek. After a moment, the static was replaced with a simple text comm.
Camera disabled. We're injured. Open dock.
Cinder reread the message until the words blurred in her vision.
It's a trap, said Wolf.
It might not be, she answered.
It is.
We don't know that for sure. He's resourceful.
Cinder, he could have survived.
Or it's a trap, muttered Scarlet.
Cinder, Aiko broke in, her voice pitched high. What should I do?
She swallowed hard and shoved herself away from the chair.
Open the dock. Both of you, stay here. Absolutely not.
Wolf fell into step beside her. She could tell that he was in fight mode. His shoulders hunched near his ears, his hands curled into claws, his stride fast and determined.
Wolf,
Cinder pressed her titanium fist against his sternum.
Stay here. If there is a thaumaturge on that ship, Aiko and I are the only ones who can't be controlled.
Scarlet latched onto his elbow.
She's right. Your presence could do more harm than good.
Cinder didn't wait for Scarlet to convince him. She was already halfway down the ladder that dropped into the ship's lower level. In the corridor between the podship dock and engine room, she stopped to listen. She heard the solid closing of the dock's doors and the life system pumping oxygen back into the space.
Dock is secured, said Aiko. Life system stabilized, safe for entry.
Cinder's retina display was panicking, as it tended to do when she was nervous or afraid. Red diagnostics flared up in the corner of her vision, laced with warnings.
Blood pressure too high, heart rate too fast, systems overheating, initializing auto-cool response.
Aiko, what do you see in there?
I can see that we need to get some real cameras installed on this ship, she responded. My sensor confirms that this podship has docked. I detect two life forms inside, but it doesn't seem that anyone has gotten out of the ship yet.
Maybe they were too injured to get out of the ship. Or maybe it was a thaumaturge, unwilling to leave the shuttle while there was still a chance they could reopen the docking doors and have everything inside sucked out into space. Cinder opened the tip of her left pointer finger, loading a cartridge. Though she'd used up all her tranquilizer darts during the fight in Paris, she'd been able to manufacture some weapons of her own, projectiles made of welded nails.
We just received another text comm from the ship, said Aiko. It says, help us.
Everything inside Cinder's head was screaming at her. Trap, trap, trap. But if it was Thorn... If Thorn was inside that ship, injured or dying. Clearing her thoughts, she reached up and punched in the dock's access code, then wrenched down the manual lever. The unlock mechanism clunked, and Cinder held up her left hand like a gun. Thorn's pod ship was sandwiched between the second pod and a wall of cords and machinery bolted to the thick paneling. Tools for loading and unloading freight, fueling equipment, jacks, air compressors, pneumatic coils. She inched toward the ship.
Thorn,
she said, craning her head. She spotted a lump of fabric in the pilot seat, a body hunched over. Shaking, she swung open the door before ducking a few steps back and aiming her weapon at the body. His shirt was soaked in blood.
Thorn!
Lowering her hand, she reached forward, rolling him toward her. An orange light brightened in the corner of her vision. Her optobionics reminding her that her eyes were a weakness. She gasped and raised her hand again, just as he shot forward, one hand wrapped around her wrist, the other clamped around her neck, his movements so fast Cinder fell onto the floor. For a moment, it was Thorn on top of her, blue eyes surprisingly calm as he pinned her to the ground. Then he morphed.
His stare became cold and crystalline. His hair grew longer and lighter, and his clothes melded into the red and gray uniforms of the Lunar Royal Guard. Her instincts seemed to recognize him before her eyes did, flaring with violent hatred. This was not any Lunar Guard. This was the guard who had held her captive during the ball, while Levana taunted her and threatened Kai, threatened everyone. But wasn't he? A fluttery laugh drifted through the air. Cinder squinted against the bright lights as a woman emerged from the pod ship. Right. The personal guard to head Thaumaturge, Sybil Mira. I had expected more from the galaxy's most wanted criminal, she said, watching as Cinder pressed her free hand into the guard's chin, struggling to push him away. The Thaumaturge smiled, looking like a hungry cat with a new toy. Stars began to speckle Cinder's vision. Shall I kill you here, or deliver you in chains to my She cut off, her gray eyes flickering toward the door. A guttural roar was followed by Wolf throwing himself against the Thaumaturge and trapping her against the pod ship. The guard's hold slackened, indecision flashing across his face as he glanced up at his mistress. Cinder swung her fist toward his jaw. She felt the crunch, and he reeled back, his attention back on her. Cinder pulled her knees up, gaining purchase, and shoved him away. She scrambled to her feet as Wolf grabbed the Thaumaturge and wrenched her back. His lips curled, revealing his implanted fangs. The guard reached for his holster, drawing Cinder's focus. He pulled the gun out. Cinder raised her hand. Two shots fired in unison. Wolf howled in pain as the guard's bullet buried itself beneath his shoulder blade. The guard grunted as Cinder's projectile found his side. Cinder pivoted, her aim seeking out the Thaumaturge's heart, but Wolf was between them, a dark spot of blood seeping through his shirt. Sybil's face was disfigured by fury as she placed her palm against Wolf's chest and snarled. Now then, she hissed. Let's remind you what you really are. Wolf snapped his jaw shut. A low growl rumbled through his throat. He spun towards Cinder, his gaze filling with bloodlust. Oh, stars, she murmured, backing up until she was pressed against the second pod ship. She held her hand steady, but she had no hope of hitting Sybil with Wolf in the way, especially now that he was under the Thaumaturge's control. Gulping, she reached out with her mind, grasping for the familiar waves of Wolf's energy, his own signature of bioelectricity, but found something brutal and feral clouding around him instead. Wolf lunged for her. Cinder switched her target, reaching for the guard instead. It felt natural, the half-second it took to calm his willpower and force him into action. In a blink, the guard was between them. He raised his gun, but was too slow as Wolf backhanded him out of the way, sending him sliding between the ship's landing gear. The gun clattered along the row of cabinets. Cinder skittered around the pod ship's nose. They made eye contact over its roof, and Wolf hesitated, his fangs bared. Cinder's internal warnings were coming so fast they blurred together, pointing out escalated heart rates and an unhealthy increase of adrenaline. She ignored them, focused only on keeping the pod ship between her and Wolf as he prowled back and forth. But then, his entire body flinched. Wolf turned and raced towards Sybil as another gunshot echoed through the dock. Wolf threw himself in front of the Thaumaturge, catching the bullet in his chest. Scarlet screamed from the doorway, a gun in her shaking hands. Panting, Cinder screamed for a weapon, a plan. The Thaumaturge was backed into a corner with Wolf acting as her shield. The Lunar Guard was curled up beneath the nearest podship, hopefully unconscious. Scarlet lowered the gun. The Thaumaturge would have no trouble controlling her. Except, the Thaumaturge had doubt in her expression and a grimace on her face. A vein was throbbing in her forehead as she cowered behind Wolf. Cinder realized with some shock that it was almost as difficult for Sybil to control Wolf as it was for her. She couldn't control anyone else so long as she had him, and the moment she released Wolf, he would turn on her and the battle would be over. Unless she killed Wolf and removed him from the equation entirely. With the blood pooling and dribbling out of his two bullet wounds, Cinder wondered how long that would take.
Wolf!
Scarlet's voice shuddered. The gun was still aimed at Sybil, but Wolf was still between them. Another gunshot made Cinder jump, the noise ricocheting off the walls. Sybil cried out in pain. The guard, not unconscious after all, had grabbed the abandoned gun, and he'd shot the thaumaturge. Sybil hissed, her nostrils flaring as she fell to one knee, one hand pressed against her thigh, already covered in blood. The guard was kneeling, gripping the gun. Cinder couldn't see his face, but he sounded strained when he spoke.
She's controlling me. The cyborg.
Cinder's lie detector flickered unnecessarily. She was doing no such thing. Although, had she thought of it before? Sybil shoved Wolf toward the guard. The energy in the room quivered, waves of bioelectricity steaming and shimmering around them. Sybil had released her power over Wolf. The gunshot had weakened her. She could no longer control him. Wolf collapsed against the guard, and they both crumpled to the ground. The guard grappled for purchase, keeping a tight hold on the gun as he shoved Wolf away. Pale and shaking, Wolf couldn't even fight back. Blood puddled around them, slickening the floor.
Wolf!
Scarlet raised the gun toward the thaumaturge again, but Sybil had already scrambled up, limping behind the nearest pod ship. Cinder drove for Wolf, grabbing him under both arms and dragging him away from the guard. He flailed his legs, his heels slipping on the blood, but otherwise offered no assistance. The guard rose up to a crouch, panting, covered in blood, his own side bleeding from Cinder's projectile. He still held the gun. As Cinder stared at him, she saw the choice. Take control of the guard before he raised the gun and killed her? Or take control of Wolf and give him the strength he needed to get out of the dock before he bled to death? The guard held her gaze for one throbbing moment before he hauled himself up and ran toward his mistress. Cinder didn't wait to see whether he was going to kill her or protect her. Clenching her fists, she blocked out everything around them, focusing only on Wolf and the bioelectricity that simmered around him. He was weak. This was not like trying to control him in their mock fights. She found her will slipped easily into his, and though his body protested, she urged him to stiffen his legs, just enough to take most of his weight off her, just enough so she could carry him, limping, into the corridor. She dropped Wolf against the wall. Her palms were sticky with blood.
What's happening?
Iko wailed over the speakers.
Keep your sensors on this corridor, said Cinder. When all three of us are safely out of the dock, shut the door and open the hatch.
Sweat dripping into her eyes, she rushed back into the dock. All she needed was to get Scarlet and let Iko open the hatch. The vacuum of space would take care of the rest. She spotted the thaumaturge first, not 10 paces in front of her. She had a clear shot. Nerves humming with adrenaline, she lifted her hand and prepared a projectile. She took aim. Scarlet leaped in front of her, her arms out in a T. Her expression was blank, her mind under the thaumaturge's control. Cinder almost wilted with relief. Without hesitating, she grabbed Scarlet around the waist with one arm and raised the other to let off a volley of projectiles toward the thaumaturge, more to keep her at bay than in hopes of doing any real damage. The last of her welded nails struck the metal walls as Cinder stumbled and fell back into the corridor. She noticed the orange light in her vision at the same moment. She screamed,
Iko, now!
As the corridor door zipped shut, she spotted Sybil racing toward the nearest pod, and a glimpse of feet on the other side of the pod ship. The guard's feet. But, blue jeans and tennis shoes? Cinder shoved Scarlet's body away with a scream. The glamour vanished, along with the orange light in her vision. Scarlet's red hoodie flickered, transforming into the lunar uniform. The guard groaned and rolled away. He was bleeding from the wound in his side.
She'd grabbed the guard. Sybil had tricked her, which meant... No! Scarlet! Iko!
She threw herself at the control panel and punched in the code to open the door, but an error flashed at her. On the other side, the docking hatch was opening. A curdled scream echoed through the corridor, and Cinder almost didn't realize it was hers.
Cinder, what's happening? What? Scarlet's in there. She has...
She raked her fingernails viciously along the door's airtight seal, unable to keep away the vision.